G'day, I'm Jonathan Green. This is Lost and Found, and this week we're in Patagonia. A wild and beautiful place, almost the end of the earth. Strangely familiar. Perhaps if you're yet to form a picture of this place, a good starting point is water. In his documentary, The Pearl Button, Chilean filmmaker Patricio Guzman described the islands off western Patagonia as a place where the Cordillera of the Andes sinks into the water and re-emerges as thousands of islands. It's a timeless place, an archipelago of rain.
Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto.
Even if you've never been, you will, I'm sure, have a picture in your mind's eye. And for good reason, Patagonia's reputation precedes it. The contemporary idea of Patagonia is a thing largely defined by its encounters with outsiders, conquistadors, explorers, tourists, travel writers.
I headed back to the Cordillera to see Charlie Millwood's old sheep station at Valle Huemules.
Writer Bruce Chatwin, reading from his memoir, In Patagonia, for the ABC in 1983.
I took a bus to Perito Moreno and got there in a dust storm. The restaurant was owned by an Arab who served lentils and radishes and kept a sprig of mint on the bar to remind him of a home he had not seen. I asked him about traffic going north. He shook his head. A few Chilean trucks, maybe, but very, very few. The distance to Valle Huemules was over 100 miles, but I decided to risk it. At the edge of town, someone had written Perón equals gorilla in blue paint on an abandoned police post. Nearby was a pile of gin bottles, a memorial to a dead trucker. His friends chucked on a bottle whenever they passed. I walked 2 hours, 5 hours, 10 hours, and no truck. My notebook contained something of the mood. Walked all day and the next day. The road straight, grey, dusty and trafficless, the wind relentless heading you off. Sometimes you heard a truck. You knew for certain it was a truck, but it was the wind. Or the noise of gears changing down, but that also was the wind. Sometimes the wind sounded like an unloaded truck banging over a bridge. Even if a truck had come up behind, you wouldn't have heard it. And even if you'd been downwind, the wind would have drowned the engine. The one noise you did hear was a guanaco. A noise like a baby trying to cry and sneeze at once. You saw him 100 yards off, a single male, bigger and more graceful than a llama, with his orange coat and white upstanding tail. Guanacos were shy animals, you were told, but this one was mad about you. And when you could walk no more and laid out your sleeping bag, there he was, gurgling and snivelling and keeping the same distance. In the morning he was right up close, but the shock of you getting out of your skin was too much for him. That was the end of a friendship, and you watched him bounding away over the thornbrush, like a galleon in a following sea. Next day, hotter and windier than before. The hot blasts knocked you back, sucked at your legs, pressed on your shoulders, the road beginning and ending in a grey mirage. You'd see a dust devil behind, and though you knew now never to hope for a truck, you thought it was a truck. Or there'd be black specks coming closer, and you stopped, sat down, and waited. But the specks walked off sideways and you realised they were sheep.
Colin Bissett is an architecture and design critic and author, and of course, a long-term friend of the program. Colin, given your architectural tastes, I am not perhaps surprised that your taste in the natural world might run to something as wildly brutal as Patagonia.
Well, it certainly is a very brutal place. I mean, I think there are lots of different Patagonias people will experience because it's such a huge area. It's both in Chile and Argentina. And, you know, when I went there. I went to the deep south, the Torres del Paine and El Chalten areas, which are where you get those great sort of granite towers and monumental mountains. Not that high, but monumental, in absolutely stunning locations. I mean, the landscapes, very sort of huge landscapes, very raw landscapes with this howling wind from the furious 50s, as they call it. So there is an architectural quality to it, just that immenseness. And yes, I suppose a bit of brutalism in there, you know, in these granite towers that make you feel terribly small. And I quite like that, of course.
I was going to say, how does the individual feel standing in the midst of that, of nature at its rawest?
Well, in Torres del Paine, which is the famous, probably the bit that most people go to, it's one of the sort of highlights of South America, I think. You've got the three sort of spires above a sort of held lake. But it's so popular that going there, it's about a 4-hour trek up to it. There were people just everywhere. And this was at the very beginning of summer. I think it gets very, very busy. And that slightly takes away from it. But then you get there. By the time you get up to this lake, you're absolutely exhausted. And there it is. And it's like walking into a vast cathedral or something. It's just vast, and you can't stop looking at it, and everyone just sits there, and people are very quiet. You know, it really makes you go inside, I think, deep inside. You really connect with, if you like, Mother Earth. It feels very, very sort of spiritual, I suppose.
Now, many kingdoms had laid claim to the lands of Patagonia. I wonder, however, have you heard of King Antoine and the Kingdom of Arautunia? Matt Yuki is a journalist and a writer based in Colombia much of the time. Matt, tell us this story, the Kingdom of Arautunia. How did that come into existence?
The short version of the story is that prior to the 1860s, the indigenous Mapuche population of southern Chile and Argentina had basically resisted Spanish conquest. They were living as independent groups of tribes on the southern tip of Latin America. And there was a Frenchman who was from the sort of impoverished nobility. He was a lawyer. He was very much influenced by tales of Spanish conquistadores and discovery. And he found out about the Mapuche, picked up sticks, and sailed to Chile, where he made contact with the tribal leaders of the Mapuche. And he basically convinced them to elect him as their king. It seems strange, and I think historically people have seen it as a little bit of a joke. But when I was in Patagonia and speaking to, you know, modern day Mapuche authors and historians, they say that there's a lot more to this story than is told in Western histories of South America.
What was his argument? What was the case he made to the Mapuche leaders?
This is the crucial point, is that under the sort of laws of discovery, when the European nations went out to conquer or discover the New World, as they put it, I should say, the basic rule was you weren't allowed to conquer an area if it was already Christian or was ruled by a Christian monarch. So given that the Mapuche had pretty much existed independently before 1860, this was a time that in Chile and in Argentina, the governments of those relatively young nations were getting their military might together to invade and push their land south at the expense of Mapuches. And Oli de Tunon understood this, but also I think the Mapuche did too. And so the Mapuche, they didn't elect Oli de Tunon because they thought he was a great leader and they wanted to live as part of a French empire. But there's a lot of evidence suggests that the Mapuche at this time were very knowledgeable about the machinations of the Argentine and Chilean governments. They knew about the plans for railroads and invasions and military forts to be constructed. And so they realized that electing Olivier de Tournon as their king would provide them with a Christian monarch, and therefore they would have a legal grounds to resist the invasion. Now, that might not seem much, but they felt, I think at that time, there was a feeling that if they could get more support, if they could convince other nations who opposed the new country, Spanish, or maybe there's talk of them reaching out to French politicians or even North American industrialists to try and gain the support that they would need to have a legal claim and then resist the march of the Argentine and Chilean armies south.
That has great logic to it. The next question is, how did that work out?
Well, it didn't work out. The long and the short of it is it didn't work out. Olivier de Tournon was very quickly captured. He was imprisoned, sentenced to death, but fortunately they managed to convince judges to spare him based on the grounds of his perceived insanity, and he spent a couple of years in a madhouse after that.
Captured by whom and imprisoned by whom?
He was captured by the Chileans. Apparently he was asleep under a pear tree on the banks of one of the major rivers, presumably thinking he was safe from harm. The Chilean military commander at the time, who went on to lead the conquest, was actually one of Chile's great stroke nefarious generals, and had got word of the Frenchman. And he actually, this Chilean general, Salvadra, basically went back to Santiago to say, hey, there's this Frenchman running around causing problems with the Mapuche. Now's the time to make a move. So in the end, it could be argued that Olivier de Tournon was actually a catalyst and sped up the invasion.
In the present day, the position of the Mapuche in those lands of Patagonia and the relationship with the Argentinians, with the Chileans, what's the position now?
I think I'll stick to the Chilean, because it's a side I know a little bit better. We've seen through the protest movements in Chile over the last 6 months, the Mapuche flag has been everywhere. It's a red, blue and green flag with a yellow circle in the middle. And it's been a very noticeable icon at these protests. One of the protests have been about the unfairness of the Pinochet dictatorship and the constitution. And Mapuche people basically feel they need to have a special place within the constitution, my understanding, to be recognized as a people. There are groups of Mapuche who want either autonomy for regions of southern Chile or, separatist movements. And there are sort of very direct action groups in Chile at the moment. A lot of that's targeted at burning equipment of forestry companies at the moment. And the Chilean state, especially in recent years, has basically militarized that zone, bringing in a lot of soldiers, some of them, having been trained in jungle commando tactics to sort of root out what they are basically painting the Mapuches as some sort of, insurgency in that part of the world. And that kicked off a couple of years ago now, I think, with a young Mapuche man being shot by one of these jungle commando members. So that's been a catalyst as well for a stronger Mapuche movement. It's taken much bigger part in the Chilean press, the struggle of the Mapuche people, and also the historical precedent and the sort of what many Mapuche historians consider the total mistelling of their nation's history in Chilean textbooks. For example, Michelle Bachelet, who was the previous president of Chile, she was often quoted as saying, the issue we have with the Mapuche is something that's been going on for 500 years, sort of dating that back to 1492 and the initial conquest of Latin America by the Spanish. And what the Mapuche historians and politicians say is that, look, this story, this existence of the Kingdom of Patagonia under this French king just goes to show that we were an independent state as late as 1860s, 1870s. And there are people alive today whose grandparents, were displaced or killed by those invasions by the Chilean and Argentine forces.
A Chilean truck did come on the afternoon of the second day. The driver was a cheerful tough, his feet smelling of cheese. He liked Pinochet and was pleased with the general situation in his country. He took me to Lago Blanco, where the lake water was a dull, creamy white, and beyond was a basin of emerald grass blocked by a line of blue mountains. This was Valle Huemules. Charlie Millwood was last here in 1919. The barkeeper remembered his moustaches. Los enormes bigotes, she said, and imitated the way he hobbled with a stick. A policeman was having his late afternoon gin, and she ordered him to drive me to the estancia. Meekly he agreed, but to show his mettle, went home for his revolver. The estancia Vajiwemules was painted red and white and bore the mark of efficient centralization. It was run by the Menendez-Bechti family, the sheep-farming moguls of the south, who, with a French wool buyer, bought Charlie out after the First World War. The manager was a German and mistrusted me on sight. I think he suspected I had a claim on the place, but he did allow me to sleep in the peon's quarters. They were in the middle of shearing. The shearing shed had 20 bays and as many shearers. Wiry Chilenos stripped to the waist, their pants shiny black with grease from the wool. A drive shaft, powered by a steam engine, ran the length of the gallery. There were noises of whirring pistons, slapping belts, ratcheting clippers and bleating sheep. When the boys tied the animals' legs, all the fight went out of them, and they lay dead weight till the torture was over. Then, naked and gashed with red cuts about their udders, they bounded wildly into the air as if jumping over an imaginary fence, or jumping to be free. After dark, the gauchos reclined against their saddles and stretched out with the ease of well-fed carnivores. The apprentices fed poplar logs into an iron stove, on which two mate kettles were boiling. One man presided over the ritual. He filled the hot brown gourds, and the green liquid frothed to the neck. The men fondled the gourds and sucked at the bitter drink, talking about mate the way other men talked about women. They gave me a straw mattress, and I curled up on the floor and tried to sleep. The men threw craps, and their conversation turned to knives. They unsheathed their own blades and compared their qualities, drumming the tips on the table. The light came from a single hurricane lamp, and the shadowy blades twitched on the white wall above my head. A Chilean shearer made comic suggestions about what his knife could do to a gringo. He was very drunk. Another man said, "I better let the gringo sleep in my room."
Gauchos and condors, sort of the cowboy life. Did that have a sort of an Australian bush resonance for you?
Again, that sort of felt rawer. I don't know if it's because the gauchos wear these red berets, which look fantastic. And they are always on horseback, and they've always got about 10 dogs with them. And I would often see them mustering sheep and mustering cattle and in these huge landscapes. And I think it doesn't look Australian. It felt very South American.
George Holmes is an associate professor in conservation and society at the University of Leeds. And he spent a couple of years studying private reserves in southern Chile. George, welcome. We tend to think of Patagonia as a wild and unfenced place, but there is a trend for buying large swathes of land in Patagonia. When did that begin?
Well, the earliest people to buy land specifically for conservation was probably in the late 1970s. But it really kicked off in the 1990s after the end of the Chilean dictatorship, most notably with Douglas Tompkins, who's, I guess, best known for founding two household name companies, the North Face, the outdoor clothing company, and Esprit, the high street clothing company that did very well in the US. He basically quit business and decided that he really liked mountaineering, went to southern Chile, a place he had visited in his youth, and decided to save it by buying it. Since then, the trend really kicked off. About 5% of Patagonia is privately owned for conservation. As a minimum, it's very difficult to get accurate statistics, but a minimum of 5% of the area. So it's very extensive. And there's a huge variety of actors involved, from middle-class families to cattle ranchers who want to diversify their income, through to these mega philanthropists and big tourism companies.
How are those acquisitions viewed locally?
Well, again, there's a huge variety. So some of the actors are local themselves, which is really interesting. As well as the private conservation areas, there's also indigenous conservation areas. So it's actually used as a tool by some of the indigenous communities to gain control of land and resources. But it has been really controversial. At the time that Tompkins started, it was just after the end of dictatorship, and this gringo comes in and secretly buys land. And the reason he secretly did it through a series of intermediaries, because he didn't want the price to go up. But then he suddenly went public and declared that me, as a foreigner, have now owned a stretch of land that basically cuts the land in two. So his first national park stretches from the Pacific coast all the way to the border to Argentina. And this was seen as a massive attack on sovereignty. It was seen as, you know, gringos coming in, a form of imperialism, a threat to Chile in some way. And it's taken about two decades for that kind of sentiment to die down. It has now died down, but it was certainly very powerful. And there was also some concern about the treatment of local people, that it was an outsider coming in and saying, all this should be conserved. It should be national park. Local people are damaging. Local people don't really belong. And that caused a lot of fuss.
I can understand how that might be. That's one side of the equation. If the goal is ecological conservation, how effective is a private reserve in achieving that end?
The data is quite mixed. One of the interesting things about Chile is that the private conservation areas tend to be in more valuable habitat than the state, the government ones. So the government national parks are basically in the leftover land, the really high mountains, the ice, the remote rocky areas that aren't really under any threat because they are so remote. But a lot of the private ones are in really valuable habitat that the government isn't protecting. So there's a really interesting additional protection going on. We're still doing a bit of work to work out whether they're actually better managed, so they conserve that area more effectively. But there's certainly strong evidence to suggest that the private protected areas in Chile are doing something that the government isn't doing.
And what's the competing land use pressure for that land?
Some of it is cattle ranching and particularly sheep ranching. There's been a massive expansion in Chile of forestry plantations. So that's another competing land use to replace the mixed native forest with exotic timber plantations. In the coastal areas, there's a rise in salmon farming, which is seen as a bit of a threat. There's too much of it and it's causing too much marine pollution. So in coastal areas, it's preventing that, the expansion of that to some extent.
That sort of farming, I mean, how much does that feed back into the local economy? How much of that is being, in its own way, a means of externalizing the returns from that land into foreign corporations?
Yeah, this is a really interesting thing, is that one of the big controversies in Patagonia in the last few years has been the proposed creation of some mega hydro dams, a series of really huge dams and reservoirs to generate hydroelectricity. These dams were going to be built by foreign companies. And those companies didn't really get the same amount of flack and controversy as of being, you know, outsiders coming in to control the natural resources as the conservationists were. To be honest, there's sort of two competing visions that are actually quite closely related for Patagonia. Both of them is about using the unique natural resources of the area for the local economic development. The conservationists want to create a sort of a chain of national parks and to have southern Patagonia as the greatest place for ecotourism in the world and have that to sustain the local economy. And then the competing vision is to use the dams, the rivers and the forests for hydroelectricity, for timber production or for farming.
Which of those is winning out, do you think?
I think it's very difficult to tell, and they're competing against each other. Both are expanding. It's a frontier situation to a large extent. All of these visions and all these industries are expanding. There have been some contractions. You know, salmon farming took a big hit recently with a virus that spread amongst the salmon population and caused a lot of the operations to go under. But at the moment, it's very difficult to tell what's the future for this area.
You've been listening to Lost and Found this week in Patagonia. You heard from Colin Bissett, Bruce Chatwin, Matt Yalke and George Holmes. Producers are Mira Andagillis and Lisa DeVisi. Technical production, Brendan O'Neill. I'm Jonathan Green. No, verdecito, sí, cierto, y me muero por una que se llama, ya ni me acuerdo, ya ni me acuerdo.
por una que se llama, ya ni me acuerdo, ya ni me acuerdo. Cierto, y así se muere el que te quiere, el que te quiere.